I doubt I'd be here if it weren't for social media, to be honest with you.
The thing to understand about a lot of these tweets, the strategy behind it, is that the controversy that follows, and often it's a controversy that's about him saying things that aren't true, it's a controversy that always posits him as the guy fighting for the little guy against the elite.
He tries to talk about issues that are very complex. He uses it to mostly attack people, insult, criticize people. The most dangerous thing he does is conduct diplomacy on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Talking Trump means, of course, talking politics. And news cycle poisoning means we all need to discharge the toxicity by trying to get a picture of politics in Trump's America. But there's more to the story of our time than politics, whatever that is. And today we're talking about tech, specifically how social media made Trump, addled our language and cognition, and landed us in this hellscape. Peter Singer, together with Emerson Brooking, is the author of Like War, a book out this month that lays out the politics, battlegrounds, and stratospherically high stakes of social media. For the book, Peter interviewed subjects as weird and diverse as reality show heel Spencer Pratt to national security heel Mike Flynn. The book is an amazing achievement, and I'm happy to have Peter here. We'll be back with Peter Singer in just a minute, but first, the most bullied person in the whole world.
And now, an excerpt from Melania Trump's bullying diary.
August 17th, dear bullying diary. Today was a very hard day of being bullied. On my way to the Rose Garden for an important press conference, Stephen Miller came up to me and said, "Melania, what is that on your blouse?" He then pointed to an area on my shirt. When I looked down to see where he pointing, he raised his finger, touched my nose, and make a booping noise. He laughed, and I felt sad. August 28th. Dear Bullying Diary. Today, in a big group meeting, I saw Stephen Miller pull out a notebook sheet of paper and write the question, "Does Melania Trump have stinky cooties?" Then he made three boxes below it, one that said yes, one that said no, and one that said maybe. He hovered his pen over the maybe box, but then moved it and made a big dark X in the yes box. This made me very sad. October 3rd. Dear Bullying Diary. I am a stinky cootie-having human being, a total loser who does not know what to say or do. Ha ha ha, I'm an idiot. October 3rd. Addendum. I speculate that Stephen Miller has stolen my bullying diary and has written the excerpt above. What am I to do about being so bullied? Hashtag be best.
Welcome to TrumpCast, Peter.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've written this book, Like War. It's one word with a capital W in between, and it is coming out this month. Tell us about Like War.
So Like War is a book that reflects over 5 years of research, basically exploring how social media has reshaped the news, politics, and war, but in turn, how news, politics, and war has changed the internet for the rest of us. The title of it is a bit of a play on words, like so much today. If cyber war is the hacking of the networks, like war is the hacking of the people on the networks through a mix of likes and lies and the system's own algorithms. It's also a bit of a play on the idea of what we've seen that relates to the story of Donald Trump, for example, this podcast topic, how military units are using information warfare techniques to influence elections, but in turn, you have teenagers and selfies and trolls and the like affecting the outcome of not just elections, but actual battles.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, this is such a fascinating topic. And the Oxford organization that researches InfoWar has said, yes, that there's some form of information warfare that hacks humans, that hacks our hearts and minds. And it seems like that's something that you have now spent a long time in the weeds of. Because, as you say, this is TrumpCast. I know your book ranges widely, but I'd like to focus on one broad but important thing. How has Trump's social media presence transformed the world as we've come to know it?
So literally, not just figuratively, to echo some of the fun things he said, literally the opening scene of the book is Donald Trump's very first tweet. And we describe it as the opening shot of a war that seemingly had nothing to do with war. And of course, it was a war that would later play out in terms of information warfare, but a war for hearts and minds in the elections, a war for the internet. And yet, you know, it's arguably one of the most important communications messages and certainly in recent American political history. And yet it had, again, nothing to do with politics. It was on May 4th, 2009. And it's, quote, "Be sure to tune in and watch Donald Trump on Late Night with David Letterman as he presents the top 10 list tonight." And it's just this funny, you know, you go back to this moment in time and both social media is at a crossroads. Twitter hasn't yet made it. It still has a relatively small user count. But then a couple of weeks later, it would be driven to revolutionary success, but actually by a different, at the time, far more well-known celebrity. It's the death of Michael Jackson that takes Twitter over the top. His passing basically convulses the internet in grief. And, you know, pop music's loss proves to be Twitter's gain. The traffic surges. It gets 100,000 tweets per hour. But more importantly, people start using social media for something new. They begin to experience an event, experience the news together online. But then you get the twin story of how Donald Trump is also at a crossroads. He's coming out of his fourth bankruptcy. Trump Entertainment Resorts has just collapsed over $1.2 billion in debt. He's been banished from the executive board. He's rebranded himself as a reality television host, but the shine is starting to wear off. You know, he likes to talk about how The Apprentice was a top 10 show, but at that point in time, it actually sunk to the 75th most watched show. It had been put on hiatus. The celebrity spinoff that he's trying to promote is still on the air, but its ratings are also plummeting. And so they turn to social media to announce an appearance on TV to try and then steer other people to watch on TV. Think about how the story is flipped. And yet what's so fascinating about it is not only does it not work, the Celebrity Apprentice season finale that year, just a few days after his first tweet, more Americans elect to watch Desperate Housewives and Cold Case instead. But also, very few people reply to it. One of the messages back is, okay. Another one is, follow me, Donald Trump. I think like a champ. But of course, this moment is an important, part of, America's political history, because his jumping online leads to the story of his rise. And we in the book track, his early tweets, how they shift, how the tone shifts, the target shift. He begins to become addicted, like the rest of us. The networks are literally designed to make you become addictive. He begins to hone some of the strategies that he'll later propel him into the presidency. He begins, for example, flame wars with fellow celebrities, which, again, if you go back in time, it's was unseemly for a supposed businessman to be getting in arguments in front of the world like a shouty teenager. But it gives him what he craves. It gives him what he needs, attention. And he understands that in this new space, and according to the new rules of the game, attention can be power, not just power online, but it can translate into power offline. And then, of course, he begins to turn his eye to politics. He changes his tone on Barack Obama, who he had previously described as someone that he was supportive of, thought he was doing really well. to, he announced, he basically surfaces an old internet conspiracy theory. See how all this circles together. He posts, mm-hmm. you know, let's take a closer look at that birth certificate. And mm-hmm. the online reaction spikes. And together, mm-hmm. Trump and Twitter begin to steer politics into uncharted territory. And, you know, it's just a fascinating story. And then, of course, you move forward, you know, about 1,000 days and social media has changed. Mm-hmm. We're not just using it, but importantly, journalists are using it. 97% of journalists are on Twitter and they're using it for their ideas of what to cover, who mm-hmm. to book on their shows, what's trending then leads the headlines. And of course, Trump's account, which had previously been posting things like, quote, everyone is raving about the Trump home mattress. It's mm-hmm. now posts, quote, I'm honored to serve you, the great American people, as your 45th president of the United States. And we know that he personally mm-hmm. posted it because honored is misspelled.
Well, that's my question about back to the first tweet and the first flame wars. So the May 4th, 2009, and, you know, in some ways with this kind of archaeology, you don't want to like press too hard on what might have been just the personal branding that people imagined the sort of second wave of Twitter was for. Maybe the first wave at South by Southwest, people were using it to make a bar plans and you know, like tag particular friends of theirs. But by 2009, even journalists are increasingly being told, like, you've got to get on Twitter and flog your pieces. When he posts this, he says, be sure to tune in and watch. And he names himself in the third person, as he's inclined to do. Donald Trump on Late Night with David Letterman. Now, there were sort of style rules also in this time, because you were doing so much self-promotion with a bullhorn, but you were supposed to be a little bit circumspect about it, you know, so like it might interest you or David. I was thrilled to be on David Letterman, or, you know, I David Letterman, as usual, you know, it, like, give the graciously give attention to other people. And he certainly doesn't do that. And also, he's chosen this handle, Real Donald Trump. So that has the accept no substitutes factor to it, you know, that there might be other people posing as him, but he's the real thing. That has a nice and irritating arrogance to it. Last sort of observation, tell me what you think of this. It looks a little like it's written by a PR adjunct, because I'm not sure that he was using, well, I don't know. What do you think?
So you covered so much there. And so I'm going to try and tick through them one by one.
Okay.
And if you'll permit me, I'm going to jump beyond just the story of Donald Trump, both
Please.
Because I think it's instructive. And frankly, the book also goes beyond it. And one of the changes that's happened that's wrapped up within the story of what's played out in American politics, but really global politics writ large, is that you have these platforms that were built for other purposes. They were not built with politics or war in mind. So, you know, just a couple years before the story of Trump's first tweet, Twitter is created essentially to allow people to instant message in terms of both businesses and for San Francisco rave dance parties. The title itself of the company is taken from a word that it's deliberately chosen for a word that means short bursts of inconsequential information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, you know, mm-hmm. we go from its short bursts of inconsequential to it has world-changing impact. You go a little bit, a couple years earlier, you have Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room, who's basically creating, he writes software to allow essentially his fellow Harvard schoolmates to rate who's hot or not. That's the origin of what's originally FaceMash and then the Facebook. And then, of course, again, it becomes By all different measures, it's the, you can look at it as the largest, in quotation marks, nation in the world. For many nations, it literally is the internet. If you're talking about Myanmar or Philippines, it's thus been woven into how mass killings have been sparked to, if we want to circle back to the story of Trump, Twitter is where Trump essentially drives the media conversation and thus the political conversation. Facebook, though, is where his organization wins the election. And there's a lot of really interesting insights we were able to uncover about how the campaign approached it, and wonderful parallels with how the campaign did it. Within the book, we do a comparison between how BuzzFeed changed the media business and how ISIS used a similar model to change the essentially the terrorism game. And one of the lessons of like war is that there are these new set of rules that these new set of rules that drive the way you operate on the internet and use it to achieve your real world goals. And it doesn't matter the type of group, you get these strange outcomes where groups with wildly different belief systems and goals are using the very same tactics because they are the winning tactics. So, for example, I mentioned whether it's BuzzFeed or the Trump campaign. Another example is the comparison between Donald Trump as an individual, Taylor Swift, and a fellow named Junaid Hussein, who was ISIS's top recruiter. They all were using very similar strategies of kind of winning in terms of it's this idea of planned authenticity. But so that what I wanted to get at is, first, there's this different origin point that you were touching on. And then, of course, they become the nervous system of the modern world. These platforms become the place where we not only post our vacation videos, they're also where, journalists decide what to cover, politicians test out their ideas, et cetera. Okay, so then the second thing you hit was the early days. His handle is at Real Donald Trump. Because early on, you had most celebrities weren't yet on it. And celebrities means not only, media figures, but politicians, business leaders, and the like. And so you had this phenomenon of squatting. It also pointed to how the companies had not yet figured out how to police their own networks. They had a hands-off approach. So if someone else puts down your name, well, they got there first. We don't have the verification and the like. And again, this illustrates some issues that would later play out because these companies are running these digital kingdoms, but they're trying to steer clear of politics, even though they become the shaping space of politics. And to kind of circle back to today, you get these outcomes where belatedly the tech companies face facts. They face up to the reality that their platforms have been hijacked for various purposes. And after the fact, they implement reforms that if they had been in there earlier, American and world politics would be totally different. If you think about, for example, the activities that Facebook and Twitter put into place in the summer of 2018 to screen out Russian bot accounts, fake accounts and the like, if those had been in place earlier, we're in a very different world. So that's the second thing that's kind of illustrated by your noting, using the handle at Real Donald Trump. The third, is you hit it exactly right. I went back and read all the old Donald Trump tweets, so you didn't have to.
Thank you.
And you see this change over time. So early on, when he first jumps online, it's pretty clear that it's not him personally. And he's actually talked about this. It's not just the evidence of it being written in the third person, but he would talk about how, if I remember the quote exactly, it was like, there were the young ladies in the office who would, type it out, bada bing for him. And it basically, in the first year of life at Real Donald Trump, was pretty obviously penned mostly by his staff, and it was mostly in the third person. And the feed was a mix of two things. It was marketing pitches for Trump branded products, vitamins, keychains, and pretty uninspired, inspiring quotes. Don't be afraid of being unique. You know, it's things like that. However, in 2011, something changes. The volume of his Twitter messages quintuple, and then they quintuple again.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So the other thing happening around 2010 and 2011 is Twitter gets a noble sense of purpose because it starts to take responsibility for the Arab Spring, which is, you know, extraordinary, but energizes the brass at Twitter. I wonder if Trump got a whiff of that. I know that Ashton Kutcher and Ray Chambers, I think, had some idea that if he raced to 1 million followers, somehow they could cure malaria. Very Silicon Valley thinking that then they would distribute malaria nets, and somehow the idea of the numbers of followers could translate into either a social movement, a political movement, or, you know, or some kind of philanthropy. And I think Twitter sort of gets its kind of sacred rage at that point, that it, and sense of its consequence. What do you think?
Essentially, the activists didn't own the internet. They'd just gotten there first. And we frame this again as a like war, because a war always involves two sides. There's always learning back and forth. So if you're looking at what plays out with the Arab Spring, yes, it's key for the toppling of the Mubarak regime in Egypt. But then the technology is utilized to help identify who activists are, help arrest them. And you get an outcome with a regime that's actually maybe more authoritarian. You see suppression in Libya and Syria that then generates a civil war. Importantly to the story of Donald J. Trump, this is also the period where young activists in Russia organize online against what has become clear that Putin's not going to leave office, that he is going to be a leader for life. And this is the period of time of arguably the greatest threat to Putin's rules. There's a series of public protests, and it's organized online, and it catches the regime off guards, and it scares them. And there's two important things that happen. The first is that they believe that this is a series of protests pushed by the West designed to topple their government, that basically the Americans are behind this all. And so it frames everything that Russia does moving forward. In their mind, it's not an information attack on the rest of the world, and America in particular. It's a defensive action. The second thing that, and of course, that moves forward to activities taken in recent elections, all the way to the upcoming fall election in 2018. The second thing that happens is part of the domestic pushback in Russia is because the Putin regime can't, it's just not doing well against this online organizing. A group of Putin supporters who are youth, there's a youth group called Nashi. Basically, they organize themselves to push back, and they create false accounts, sock puppet accounts, and they argue back and post false stories and the like about the other their protesters. And it's the origin of what would later become the effort in terms of what's known as the Internet Research Agency and the like. Basically, the Putin
This was the subject of the indictments, right, in February, the Mueller indictments that really spelled out what the Mueller charge is, which is conspiracy to defraud the United States, right, in the hands of this Internet Research Agency.
Exactly. That is the group that it comes out of this youth group originally. And then it's essentially contracted by the Putin regime to turn it into an organization. And that's where you get things like the Internet Research Agency that's later deployed out. But I wanted to hit one thing. So you circle back to, you know, you have this sort of political optimism, but all the figures are figuring out essentially how to turn it back, how to tool it into a weapon in their own hands. This, just as you note, sort of crosses with this moment where Trump is personally discovering Twitter, but his eye is also starting to turn to something else. So if you look at it in 2011, as I mentioned, the volume of his messages is quintupling. The next year it quintuples again. The verbiage of it shifts from being third person to first person. You can also begin to figure out when it is being done by someone else who's basically taking what he says and tapping it out, and that's during business hours, to, you know, his famous late night tweets and the like. Another important thing is that the tone and the language shifts. This at real Donald Trump is real, and it's real combative. It picks online fights regularly. Remember Rosie O'Donnell and the like. And the language becomes it sharpens and becomes a Trump mainstay. You know, this is when loser, weak, dumb reaches into the hundreds of occurrences. But then, as you note, they get this wonderful twist. As the feed becomes more personal, it also becomes more political. And he begins to target, you know, everything from China, Iran, trade, Kwanzaa, to Barack Obama. And what, and just like he did to his, you know, other celebrity targets, he launches hundreds of these bombastic attacks. And this is the transformation where he begins to use his Twitter feed to flirt with running for office. What's fascinating, one of the other people that we interviewed, it is part of this story of Trump, is General Michael Flynn.
Yes, who you talked to for the book, right?
Yeah, just as he's joining the Trump campaign. This is one of the...
Michael Flynn and Spencer Pratt, I think, together for the first time. It's really finally a blockbuster book that way.
Yeah,
yes, exactly. We've all been longing for that.
And Flynn's entry into social media, his first post is also in 2011. And literally, it only one person reacts to it. No one replies to it. No one retweets it. It's an anodyne post about Middle East news. But then when he, you know, leaves DIA, gets sucked into this world of politics and all the things that have gotten him in trouble since, but also his online presence changes. And he becomes a font of conspiracy theory. And, you know, by contrast with getting like one reaction to posting a news article, when he posts articles on things like Hillary secret child sex ring to hashtag spirit cooking, which is the conspiracy theory that there is a secret DC cabal of elites who gather for dinner to drink human blood and semen. I mean, this is kooky stuff. But when he's posting...
Wait, this is Mike Flynn himself, not Mike Flynn Jr. This is Mike Flynn Sr.
Yes, Sr.
He posted on Pedogate and the spirit drinking or whatever. I didn't quite realize that.
Cooking.
When he...
I don't want to lose it, because that message gets him 4,800 likes.
My question there, and I can imagine that was very intoxicating to General Mike Flynn to get a lot of likes on Twitter. Who doesn't like getting likes on Twitter? Although one thing with digital non-natives, when they get on Twitter and they like put on their dancing shoes and decide the most important thing is to get likes, there's something so undignified and humiliating about it to see them, you know, and you know, I will say I was surprised with even seeming heroes or semi-heroes of the resistance like James Comey getting too into Twitter. I mean, those of us who'd been there since it debuted at South by Southwest were kind of like, what? Like, come on. You know, the preening and the excitement about the number of likes. The other thing is, and we've speculated on this show about when Mike Flynn broke bad and seemingly went to work for the Turks, how that happened to a general, how he got his head turned by...
I mean, you don't have to caveat it with seemingly. Yes. I mean, you've okay, gotten a contract right. of a $530,000 deal. This is the great thing of a book.
The you're talking about the rendition, the rendition contract with Erdogan. All these fascinating Mike Flynn stories. But the speculation for him and earlier speculation for another internet politician, Ron Paul, the speculation about Mike Flynn is that he was getting a lot of bot support and amplification for some of the most, wingnut tweets. And that became amplifying far right American voices became of interest to certain autocrats that wanted to influence American politics. What do you think of that? I was hacked by a Turkish group on Twitter not long ago, and it's a formidable operation they have there, the Turkish cyber army.
So with Flynn, there's the fascinating story of, as you describe it, his turn. And we use him as he's a real world character who illustrates kind of the two sides of the social media revolution. He spoke about how, as a military officer, the rise of the internet was one of the biggest changes of his career, and it changed the way he looked at the world and the value of information. And that, in particular, it links to this story of what's known as OSINT, open source intelligence. So HUMINT is like spies. SIGINT yep. is code breaking. OSINT is the idea that the information's out there in the open. And he said, when he starts out in his career, OSINT is the, in his words, like the redheaded stepchild. It's of no value. No one really mm-hmm. wants it. And then with the rise of the internet, suddenly it's all out there. His phrasing was, there's gold nuggets just waiting to be collected. Mm. And mm-hmm. It's part of how he helps lead the effort to, run down remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to his ideas for remaking not just the Defense Intelligence Agency when he's made the director of it, but the intelligence community writ large. It's kind of part of his big vision, but then it kind of collapses for a variety of reasons, and his aggressive moves, his management style, et cetera, basically is like too much, and he's forced into retirement. And you have this kind of moment, like if that was just the story, Flynn would be portrayed as one of these forward-looking kind of prophet of the social media revolution, mm-hmm. who paid the price for seeking change. But of course, his tale doesn't end there. And just as it's everything from he personally doesn't take the dismissal well. He channels his energy into kind of two things. One is making money through a consulting business. And two, he's becomes known as a critic of the Obama administration, but not just a typical critic. It's pretty extreme. It's they're betraying the nation, and it gives him celebrity and money beyond his dreams that he had made in the military. But it brings in these new entanglements, whether it's the $530,000 contract with the Turkish government-linked company that becomes questionable when he fails to register as a foreign lobbying agent, to $45,000 to speak at a Russian government-sponsored gala, and he sits next to Vladimir Putin. But most important, it brings him to the attention of Donald Trump, who had just announced his run for office but doesn't have advisors and campaign surrogates that he needs. And Flynn is scheduled to meet with Trump for 30 minutes. When their conversation ends 90 minutes later, he comes away with another insight into the future. He says, quote, "I knew he was going to be president of the United States." Mm-hmm. And, Flynn then becomes his, he'd been known as the angriest general, and he becomes, one of Trump's angriest campaign surrogates, but also kind of burnishes him with, here's an ex-general speaking on behalf of this real estate tycoon. But it also, of course, just as we were talking about, he dives deeper into the online world that previously he'd been an observer of, and the result is just not pretty. And, we talk about all these conspiracy theories. He mm-hmm. posts messages of hate. There's retweets of anti-Semitic messages. And what was just so remarkable about it is that it works in a certain way for him. He becomes, you know, Trump wins. He becomes a national security advisor, one of the most powerful positions in the U.S. government. It surprises all his old military peers, you know, who thought he was done. And instead, now he's their boss. But then the winning that he had announced, you know, he tweets out, quote, "We're going to win and win and win at everything we do." Mm-hmm. And then within a few weeks, he's fired, done in by a series of mistruths. And he admits in a plea bargain with the Department of Justice to making, quote, "false, fictitious, and fraudulent statements." But what mm-hmm. was remarkable to kind of this discussion that we had is he talked about how there are these gold nuggets out there, but what he had not included is that there is pyrite, that there is fool's gold intentionally planted, cleverly engineered to distract or even destroy us. And so we have this space where the truth is now out there, but it can be buried underneath a sea of lies, and those lies can be turned into weapons.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Wow. And weapons that in some cases seem to have been used on him. I guess I want to wrap with something I hope is a little bit optimistic, which is that those listeners, you know, there are certainly listeners to TrumpCast who are young enough to think that Twitter and Facebook are idiocy and are thought control. And, you know, I will, like, I think I've mentioned on the show before, but my 13-year-old son absolutely refuses to have a phone on the grounds that it's like emasculating, that it will curb his resourcefulness because he'll rely on GPS. You know, he texty tweety, emoji emoji, he says, when he sees me with my phone. Like, he just thinks a smartphone is an emblem of your slavery. And it's sort of a pain when I have to try to, his friends are trying to reach him by text and I, you know, he has to find his way to a payphone. But it does seem like that practice, certain millennials that are going to flip phones are much more interested in security than they are in connection. Do you think that's a legitimate option to sort of to opt out?
No. Short answer, no. And while it's laudable, the reality is that is not the case for the vast majority of us. And I would argue should not be the case. How are you and I talking right now? We're not doing it through a flip phone. How are we sharing our information with an audience? It's through this network.
You're never not on the internet.
Yeah. So what I would get at is a couple of things for why this isn't an answer. One is that much of the world does not have the luxury to make that kind of choice. Large parts of the world, their experience with the internet is via social media. So the internet in the Philippines is really Facebook. And that is only going to continue as the second half of the world comes online. So one, a large number of people don't have a choice. The second is individually, a lot of us don't have a choice because it's addictive. It's psychologically, physically addictive. It's designed to be that way. Even the color red for the Facebook alerts was deliberately chosen that way because it attracts your eye and then it makes you feel good when you make red go away. Any campaign that says, you know, just stop using social media will be as successful as the Just Say No campaign that is now rightly mocked on social media. Mm-hmm. So instead, what we have to do is understand the new rules of the game. And that's what the book was about, is that to make a, you know, a pop culture reference, it's like the movie Rounders and the game of poker. If you sit down at a poker table and you don't know who the mark is, you're the mark. And it's not just a generational thing. I wish it was true that, you know, oh, millennials get it and boomers don't. But again, the actual studies show that your age your education level, your intelligence level, none of them are an inoculator from being taken in online by disinformation, fake news, echo chamber effects. None of those. It's actually understanding how to navigate this world. The threat's not going to go away. It's continuing to hit, you know, everything from the recent Mexican election to the Brazilian election to it's shaping what's happening in the 2018 election. It's also, you know, for all our discussion, it's bipartisan. Both sides now, while some people kind of stumbled into the tactics, you know, maybe Trump kind of was a natural, it's now there's a series of new rules of the game that both sides are using. And so it's not going away. And we better understand it. That's the only way to succeed moving forward.
Well, I recommend your book on this score, Like War, to listeners. Thank you so much for being here, Peter.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. What'd you think? Let us know the good and bad by tweeting at RealTrumpCast. And you can also tweet at me. I'm Paige 88. Any ideas of what you want to talk about next? We're out there on the Twitter machine and we're listening. Again, our Twitter handle is at RealTrumpCast. Follow us. And then you got to do one more thing. You got to sign up for Slate Plus. It's Slate's membership program. And, you know, if you've been taking this show for free, stop being a taker and start being a giver. You'll get TrumpCast ad-free, bonus episodes just for members, and more. Visit slate.com/plus. Our show today was produced by AC Valdez and Melissa Kaplan, with help from Shirley Chan. Kate James, Asher Perlman, and Steve Waltin performed today's sketch. And I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.